From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative healthcare, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today is Martin Gray. He is an author, speaker, specializing in anthropology, environmentalism. He visits and photographs ancient sacred sites around the world, and he has written a book entitled Planetary Acupuncture, PowerPoint Sacred Sites, and the Healing of the Earth. Welcome to the show, Martin Gray.
Thank you very much,
Bruce. Martin, I think it would be good to start out for our audience sake and ask you how all this started. Specifically, what is planetary acupuncture?
Well, how it all started for me was my parents. My father was a military pilot, and I was, when young, very lucky to be able to travel around the planet a lot, and my father's hobbies were archaeology and photography. So since I was a little boy, I spent a lot of time at ancient archaeology sites photographing them. And then when I was 12 years old, moved to India, where I lived for 4 years, and during that time spent a whole lot of months traveling around India, visiting ancient sacred sites and pilgrimage shrines, and I conceived of this desire to one day put together a photographic atlas and anthropological guidebook to sacred places around India and perhaps even the world. Then I came back to the United States, and I was going to college at the University of Arizona studying Mesoamerican archaeology, and came to understand that many ancient cultures had ceremonial sites, sacred sites, and I again became interested in photographing them and doing research on those. So that's one of the ways that it kind of started. And then I went back to India, and I spent a number of years living in a monastery over there, and came back from India and started some travel agencies. And then a very strange thing happened to me, actually. I began having a kind of series of visionary experiences that indicated that I should begin visiting these sacred sites. And so I sold my travel companies, and I got a bicycle, and did most of my travels around the world by bicycle, and visited about 400 of these sites in over 50 countries now.
Let's talk specifically about a particular idea that you have, and many of the listeners, I'm sure, have heard this, but you take the term Mother Earth as a literal meaning, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Well, I don't so often say Mother Earth, but a living Earth. I definitely believe the Earth is a living being. It just is a different sort of being, as we are different than butterflies. It moves at a slower pace. And so a lot of people, they lack the temporal and spatial perspective to be able to notice this as a living being. For example, sometimes they say that if we could live 25,000 miles up above the planet, like when you see photographs taken by the Apollo missions, they're often taken up about that height. And if you could live for 200 or 300 million years and look down on this being, and 200 or 300 million years is really pretty short when you consider it's been here for 4.5 billion. If you look down on this planet for that period of time from that distance, you would see the continents moving around and the grasslands sweeping across the surface of the Earth and these rippling mountain chains, and you'd understand that it was alive. But because we only live 50-60 years and we live at ground level, it's hardly an appropriate vantage point to be able to comment upon the livingness of this Earth.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the visionary experience that you had. You have had information then that is private. It's certainly privy to you, which has explained the nature of power points on the Earth, haven't you?
Well, see, another reason that I got into this whole study is in researching the religions of the world. You'll often find that the primary religious figures in these, and the founding figures in these religions, they had their enlightenment experiences at particular places on the planet. And you'll find very often accounts of people having heard, you know, this is the way it's spoken of, having heard the voice of God. as fact. Well, I wondered, this happens all over the planet. You find accounts like this in virtually every religion of the world, and I thought it's got to mean something, that all over the planet people have talked about certain places having a power to induce visions in human beings. So I thought, well, I'll go visit it and see what happens. And after a couple of years of traveling to these sites, I began to experience a similar sort of thing where I would be at one of these PowerPoints and I'd be sitting in meditation at the site and I would in fact hear things and see things. You know, I'd be sitting there with my eyes shut meditating and then stuff would come into my mind that was not a function of my own linear thought process.
Now, you talk about specifically the Greek oracle site of Delphi. That's a well-known example. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Delphi is one of about 15 oracle sites that were very prominent in that period of, you know, 1500 BC up to, you know, around the time of Christ. There were a number of oracles, like 15, maybe even 25 oracle sites around the Greek Mediterranean world, all the way over into Turkey and into northern Africa. And it's my feeling that ancient people, long before the arrival of the Greeks, had found these particular sites on the earth and had certain experiences. And then as the Greek Empire grew, they took over these sites. And the legends at these sites are that people would go to them and sometimes they would drink waters of a sacred spring or eat some leaves, but sometimes they'd just go into a cave. There's a place called Cumae kind of in Italy where there's a big cave and people would go into that. And when they were at these sites, they would have experiences that they interpreted it as visions of the future. So the way that I articulate or try to describe how the energy of these sites affects people is that it catalyzes the psychic ability of precognition. It's my belief that, and scientists are now saying that most human beings only utilize somewhere between 5 and 15% of their inherent mental faculties. It seems like we have an extraordinary intellectual psychic capacity, but we don't know how to access it. And it's my belief that by going to some of these PowerPoints, there's an energy at these places that kind of opens doors in our minds, awakens us to an ability to utilize some of these inherent capacities, one of which is this ability to somehow peer into the future in some way. So Delphi was just a place, and it became a very well-known one because in Greek history, it's not the most important one, it's just one of many ones, but it's one of those sites where people saw visions.
In your vision, you said in the book that basically there were three important issues that you learned about, and if I'm correct, and of course you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you basically said that there were reasons why certain geographical locations are used as settlement sites. You said that the even though they're separated by thousands of miles, they have distinctly similar cultures and identical legends. And thirdly, that humans are supposed to have an emotional and physical spiritual relationship with the earth. Could you comment on those things that I've just said? There are a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, the first one is that you brought up, and I think it's important, is how did these places get discovered and how did they come to be utilized as sacred places? And I often like to speak about Europe. Around 10,000 BC in Europe, the last ice age was receding, and this land that had previously been covered by a mile-high sheet of ice, as the ice melted and the sheet receded, this barren land began to be colonized by lichens and mosses and shrubs and grasses and trees, and these herds of animals from southern Europe moved north, and what followed them were the nomads, our ancestors, hunter-gatherers. And at that time, people didn't live in buildings. They just wandered across the surface of the earth, following the migratory herds of animals and getting their foods and grains and seeds and nuts out of the forests and the prairies. Well, as they wandered across the surface of the earth, they came upon these energy lines that crisscross the earth, and where these energy lines meet, there are these power points. Well, they began marking them with stones so that if the next year or 10 years later they or somebody in their tribe wandered in the same area, they would see some stones had been placed, because you can't see these sites. You can't see the energy, you only feel the energy, and you can only feel it when you're in the general proximity of it. So they would mark them so that if they were walking on one hill and way off in the distance they saw a hill with a clump of stones, they would think, oh, somebody in our proto-tribe has marked this place, and then they would go over there. Well, then about 6,500, between 6,500 and 3,500 BC in Europe, people learned how to grow crops and herd animals. And why that's important is it allowed them to settle in a fixed place for the first time. Most anthropologists, they speculate about why did people choose settlement sites? What was the reason? And they'll say, well, it was military, it was commercial, it was agriculture. Yet the earliest nomadic people, they weren't carrying on commerce with one another. There's no evidence of military activity, and there was very little agriculture. So it's my theory that a lot of the earliest settlement sites, people settled at places that were sacred to their nomadic ancestors.
Now, let me interrupt for 1 second, Martin. You're saying then that these is ley line, right?
Ley lines is a term that a guy named Alfred Watkins began using in 1921. And Alfred Watkins never talked about energy lines on the Earth. All Alfred Watkins had done was go out and visit and photograph Neolithic sites and Bronze Age sites and pre-Reformation sacred sites, and he would mark them on a map, and one day he noticed they were all in straight lines, and he postulated some ideas, and he called them ley lines. But he never dowsed, and he never talked about energy lines. Nowadays, people that talk about these lines happen to call them ley lines, but ley lines does not, its accurate definition doesn't have anything to do with an energy line.
Okay, well, the nature of my question is this. We have these energy lines which were, let me see if this is correct now, they were cognized by the ancient people, is that right?
Yes.
All right, so the problem is that as people began to quote-unquote evolve, they lost track of what these were?
Well, they lost track of, I think they lost track of what they were. But what it's really an interesting study, you see, because people settle down, and I think the first people settling at these sites, they were very, very sensitive to the Earth energies, and they felt those energies all of the time. Well, then they began to notice that at certain times of the year, the energies come out of the Earth more strongly than other times of the year, and they also noticed that it had some sort of relation to lunar, stellar, and solar patterns. So they began to erect increasingly complex astronomical observatories at these sites so they could watch the rising and the falling of the stars and predict in advance of their occurrence when those days were going to be. Now, this is taking place over hundreds and thousands of years, and as that occurs, I think people more and more lost the sensitivity to the Earth, and religions and ritual arose at the sites. So the latter-day people, because you can see this in Europe, some of these sites were discovered as early as 6,000, 7,000 B.C., and they became the major ceremonial sites for thousands and thousands of years, and the latter-day cultures that used them in a different way than the earlier people used them. I think they forgot about the energies of the Earth. They lost the sensitivity to be able to experience them.
All right, now I don't mean to jump around, and of course if I am, you can always correct me, but I'm wondering, can we just talk for a moment then about Machu Picchu and Rano Raraku?
Well, Machu Picchu is the site in the Peruvian Andes that was sacred to the Inca, and Rano Raraku is a volcano on the island of Easter Island.
Now, both of these sites, then, are places where people would have experiences of, what, telepathy or different types of impressions?
People experience it at all sites because each site has a different energy. It's like on the human body, and that's one of the reasons I call my subject planetary acupuncture, is I'm trying to draw a lot of parallels between human acupuncture. And if you study human acupuncture, you're going to find that there's a bunch of energy meridians on the body. There's a meridian for the large intestine, the small intestine, the kidney, the liver, the heart, the stomach. They all have different energies. There's one energy that moves through them, but when it's in a particular meridian, it has a certain energetic characteristic. And the information that I received and the information that a lot of other people are talking about that are in this field indicates that different power points affect different people in different ways.
So the purpose of your work, and I must admit that it's new to me in the sense that I don't know a lot about it. I understand the similarities that you're drawing between the Earth as a living, breathing entity and the humanoid as a living, breathing entity, and the fact that both have these energy lines and that they are affecting each other. The question that I'm having then is, are we dependent on the energy lines on the Earth, or are these mutual exclusive events?
I don't think we're dependent upon them in any way. I think that we can benefit from the energies at these sites, and it's been indicated to me that the Earth benefits by people going to these sites. The whole theory behind acupuncture is you place a needle into an acupuncture point. What it's doing is it's stimulating energy at that point, and it's moving energy along the acupuncture meridians. And as the energy in the body becomes balanced that way, then the body comes into its natural and spontaneous state of health. And it has been indicated that for people going to these sites and practicing meditation at these sites, that the human beings, in fact, become the acupuncture needle of the living Earth.
So now what you're telling me is something that I'm excited about. The Earth then is, in a sense, this is an interdependent thing, and that we can enliven the process of the Earth?
That's what I believe.
And let's talk a little bit about their distribution, their energetic characteristics, and the effect upon humans, even though we've spoken a little bit about that.
It seems to me that the points are equally and geometrically distributed all across the surface of the Earth. Now, 72% of the surface of the Earth is underwater, so we don't know where they are. And the ones on land, sometimes we don't know where they are because they're in mountainous regions or in deserts. But very often, if you study the anthropology and archaeology of early cultures, you will find that the first places people lived were actually ceremonial sites. So one of the ways in which you find these places is to do some research into a particular area and find out where did people first settle, where are the earliest cities.
Now, people cannot see this, but I'm going to see if I can describe. You have a diagram, which is a beautiful diagram of the Earth, and it looks very geometric. Even you say that when you first saw the vision of all the subfields that compromise this total planetary field, you were overwhelmed with the beauty of it. I'm overwhelmed with the beauty of it myself. Could you comment a little bit on that?
Well, initially, the visions I saw indicated that there were all these points all over the surface of the Earth, and there seemed to be a geometric order to them, but I couldn't discern what that order was. I was merely seeing points of light on the surface of the Earth and a lot of lines radiating between them. And I always thought there is some order to this, and there's something determining this order, but I didn't know what it was. Then at one site in Greece, I had a vision that indicated that inside the Earth, there is a energy field in the shape of an enormous crystal, and where the vertex points of this crystal hit the interior sphere of the Earth determines where the power points are on the surface of the Earth. And this field is composed of a bunch of subfields, and the subfields are analogous to the acupuncture meridians, the different acupuncture meridians of the human body. And different subfields have different energies. And when I received that information, it explained something to me. You'll find very often legends about sacred places, and there'll be two sacred places halfway around the planet from one another, and the people had never had any cultural contact, but there's the same sort of legend at both sites, and it's often mystified archaeologists as to how that occurred. And my feeling is that these points, the sacred sites, are on the same grid, the same energy line, and therefore people experience the same type of energies and evolve a similar legend.
Now, there's so much to discuss. I would like to, and you can again tell me if I'm jumping too far, but could we discuss for a moment and perhaps explain what dowsing is and how dowsing helps us understand where these energy lines are?
Well, dowsing, what is dowsing? Human beings are an extraordinarily sensitive sensing device. Most people don't know they are, but we have these capacities. What dowsers do is they've highly refined their intuitive sensing capacities, and a lot of times they'll use a tool, a Y rod, some L rods, various little devices that they hold in their hand, and the tools themselves do not find anything or sense anything. They merely magnify a response that our central nervous system has. Our central nervous system is experiencing something, and then the dowsing tools register the response that we're having and make it visible. Dowsers, most people have heard of dowsers looking for water or looking for oil or looking for gold. Somehow, and this has never been explained, dowsers, they'll set up a thought, an intention in their head of what they're looking for, and when they're very clear about what they're looking for, somehow their nervous system responds to that thing that they're looking for. There's a fellow named Rupert Sheldrake that talks about morphogenetic fields, and he says that all elements, all species, each element has a particular energy field that emanates out of it. Well, human beings somehow conceptually, intellectually, mentally, psychically can tune into those energy fields, and as one practices this, one gets better and can find things. The dowsing that a lot of people do at sacred sites is they actually look for these energy lines, and they want to follow the energy lines along to where the energy is the most intense. Sometimes where these lines intersect, there's a circle about 2.5 to 4 feet in diameter where a beam of energy comes out of the earth. And by dowsing, one can find these sites.
Now, of course, we all understand scientific procedures. So it seems to me that if different people at different times can come to the same conclusions as far as these energy lines are concerned, then this is not some theory, is it?
Oh, it's not a theory. It's not a theory at all anymore. Some of the things that I'm saying are pretty theoretical about how the energies affect people. But it's not theoretical that energies exist at these sites. There's an anthropologist in England named Paul Devereux who's got a number of books out. And about 10 years ago, he started something called the Dragon Project, which brought together a bunch of geophysicists and archaeologists and psychics and dowsers and a lot of different people to monitor the energies at the Stone Rings. And they monitored energies at Stone Rings in England for a bunch of years, primarily concentrating on a stone ring called Rollright.
Now, could I just interrupt you, and could you explain to our listeners what a stone ring is?
Well, a lot of people call them stone circles, you know, like Stonehenge. People think of Stonehenge as a circle. Stonehenge is pretty much a true circle. Most of the stone, the megalithic stone constructions in Europe are not, in fact, circles. They're only about 2% of them are circles. The other 98% are ellipses. Each one of them varies in its shape. And these stone rings were put up all in Europe basically from around 3000 to 1000 BC, and they had two functions. The secondary function is the stones in the perimeter of the ring are used as observation devices to watch the rising and the falling of the sun and the moon and the stars on the horizon. And that, again, was so they could predict in advance of their occurrence the arrival of certain days when the energy comes most strongly out of the earth, because then they wanted to know about it in advance so they could call people from the surrounding countryside for a festival. Well, then there's stones in the center of the stone rings, which are very often of a different mineral content and usually very, very high in quartz or quartzite. These stones were used as sort of batteries. They gather and concentrate and emanate the energy of the earth for the people. You were asking me a question about stone rings before that?
Well, I was... actually, what happened was you were talking about the fact that the stone rings exist around the world, and I had asked you what they were before you began talking about them.
Well, this Dragon Project, what they did is for a period of years, they monitored the energies at Rollright Stone Ring and a bunch of others, and they found that actually on the solstices and the equinoxes, the cross-quarter days, which are the days in between the solstices and the equinoxes, and on full moons and on particular other lunar dates, that there was actually an increase in electromagnetism and in radioactivity and in ultrasound at all of these sites. And so it's been postulated that ancient people, they didn't have instruments that could sense ultrasound or radioactivity, but they could feel it. And we now know that low-level magnetism, you know, helps heal bones. Ultrasound does things to tired muscles. So the ancient people, maybe they didn't use words and they didn't to talk about ultrasound, and they didn't have machines to sense these things, but they sensed them themselves. So there are, in actuality, increased energy manifestations at these sites that you don't find in the surrounding countryside.
So their use of the calendar was quite a bit different from ours. We use a calendar to know what day we're going to pay our bills or what day we go to work or where we're going. They're using it for knowing when particular occurrences, namely these vortexes occur on the earth. Is that correct?
I think so. A lot of people look at the solstices and the equinoxes as having something to do with the agricultural calendar, but this isn't accurate. A number of the days don't have anything to do with the agricultural calendar. And ancient farmers, they didn't so much plant by what the sun was doing, but they watched the other plants that were already growing. When certain things dropped their seeds, they knew it was time to plant. I feel that the use of the solstices and the equinoxes, or the measuring of those, the calendrical indications of those, had very much to do with the energies emanating out of the earth. And it's interesting to note that in the eight primary Christian festival days are all either exactly on or clustered right around the solstice, two solstices, two equinoxes, and then the four cross-quarter days.
Well, as a matter of fact, for our listeners, Easter is what? I can never remember what it is. It is the first Sunday after the first full moon, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it moves around.
But I'm saying that's why it moves, which a lot of people are always wondering, you know, why? How do people know when Easter is supposed to be? And that, of course, is one of the reasons. It is actually, I guess, astrological in a sense.
You'll find this all over the world, that one culture takes over the sacred places of an earlier culture, and they take over the sacred dates of the earlier culture, and then they just impose their own religion on them.
Now, what is the view in Europe as far as PowerPoints are concerned?
Europeans are much, much more tuned into this. It's much better understood. There's a much larger audience for what I'm doing over there than there is here in the United States.
But that doesn't mean that we don't... I mean, we have certainly our own PowerPoints here in the United States, is that correct?
They're equally and geometrically distributed. They're everywhere.
So how would we use them? And perhaps maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the ones that are here in the United States that you have discovered, and perhaps we can learn a little bit about them.
Well, we don't know of too many in the central United States, but in the eastern United States, up and down the eastern seaboard, there are a lot of so-called burial mounds. But that area is so settled, and when the settlers came in, they took over so many of the sites, and the grave robbers have defaced a lot of them. So we don't know where a lot of them are. And also the American Indians in the East, they built a lot of times with wood, and the wood has since decayed, whereas the Indians that built out in the West built with stone, and the stone structures are still there. All over the southwestern United States and up and down the western United States, all the way into Canada, there's lots and lots of stone rings. And then the Anasazi people and other cultures built a lot of magnificent sites at some of these PowerPoints.
You have a chance to travel around the United States. I guess the visions that you had have been very important to you, and I wonder if you could tell our listeners why you go out and talk and give these lectures.
Well, about 6 years, 8 years ago, actually, I was at a sacred site in Japan, and it's a Shinto site called Izumo no Taishan, the west coast of Honshu. And there was a big festival that was happening in there. And went to the festival, and then the day after the festival, I was up on top of the sacred hill overlooking the shrine, and I sat to do some meditation, and I received a lot of visionary material that indicated that I would be traveling. This was just at the beginning of my travels, actually, and it indicated that I would be traveling to these sites all over the planet. And there were actually three reasons that I would be doing that. The first was to gather information about these sites and photographs of them to share with people around the world, because many people in the next few years would be attracted to visit these places, and they wouldn't know where they were or the appropriate response to their attractions. And so by me going out and showing photographs of the sites, people would know where they were. And it was interesting, as I traveled around the world over the next number of years, when I was at the sites, I would interview people and ask them, why are you here? And a lot of times I came upon people who told me, sometimes they were hesitant to share this at the beginning, but then I told them what I was doing and they opened up. They would say they had, since they were young children, been attracted to pictures and books, or they had dreamed over and over and over again of a particular place, and they'd never known where it was or what it meant. They had just always wanted to go there. And so then sometimes they'd see it in a PBS documentary or a BBC documentary, or they'd see it in a book. And then they'd go and they'd have powerful experiences at these sites. And now at my slideshows, a lot of times people come up at the slideshows and they point out pictures that I'm showing. And they say, that's the site I've been seeing in my head for a long time. Where is it? So what was initially indicated to me in the vision, that people would be doing this, in fact, did occur. Another reason that I was told to visit these sites was to do this thing called planetary acupuncture. And it was explained to me that human beings can have an energetic and a healing effect upon the planet by going to these sites and, in a sense, giving love to the Earth. And maybe that sounds a little bit esoteric, but, you know, we give love to our cats and our dogs and our wives and our plants. Why can't we do it to this large being, the Earth? And so one time, after a number of years of travel, actually, I was on a sacred mountain in Colorado called Hesperus. And while I was there, some information came, and indicated that there was a particular meditation technique, a very simple breathing technique that one can do when one's at a sacred site. One can do it anywhere, which actually allows you to build up a certain energy field inside of your being and then send it into the earth. And now in my slideshows, I hand out a diagram about how to do that, and I teach that to people, and they all practice it a little bit, and then they can do that wherever they are. And then the third reason that I thought was really, really, really interesting, and some people might have a hard time understanding what this meant, but if you study Hinduism and Buddhism and certain Asian religions, they talk a lot about reincarnation. They talk how the soul is infinite, and or ageless, and it keeps coming back into body after body after body. Well, it was indicated to me that there are a lot of people alive on the planet today that prior to their birth in this particular incarnation, they were offered an opportunity to come here to this planet and do something of service during this very difficult time that we're living in. And they accepted that opportunity of doing service, and they came here and they forgot when they were born. They got a sort of amnesia. They forgot who they were and what they were to do. And by going to these sacred sites, the energy that comes out of the earth at these power points, it awakens people to an understanding of what their real destiny is. And it was important, said to be, it was very important for me to go out and to talk to people about this and to kind of encourage people to follow their yearnings to go visit these sites and reconnect with the earth at these places, because maybe they would have an awakening of what they were supposed to do while they were here on the planet. So that's one of the main reasons that I go out and I speak about this. And the other thing is, I think it's very important that we human beings give something back to this earth that we take so much from. And I speak a lot about service. I speak a lot about saying thank you to the earth with our actions, because we breathe this air, we drink the water, we eat the food, we live upon the planet, and we don't do very much for the planet but take, take, take. And the planet is suffering very much because of the growing human population. We're causing all of these problems. And there's such a greed nowadays among people that they're always trying to take care of themselves, and they're kind of cutting off the branch that they're sitting on. So one of the things that I talk a whole lot about is that we need to see that we're part of an ecosystem, that we're not separate from this ecosystem, that this earth is dying in great measure because of us, and that we need to change our ways. We need to really begin serving the planet.
Now, of course, one of the unfortunate jokes, which is, of course, on us, is that the Earth certainly can exist without us, but we can't exist without her.
Yeah.
Tell me, you, of course, mention in your book probably one of the greatest and most well-known structures, stone structures, of course, are the pyramids. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, there's very little known about the pyramids. Egyptologists, that particular type of archaeologist that focuses on Egypt, they will say that the pyramids are, or at least the ones on the Giza Plateau, are funerary structures of some kings in the third or fourth dynasty. I can't remember which one it is. But actually, that there's no archaeological evidence that the pyramids were in fact built by the Egyptians. They certainly weren't funerary structures when they were broken into by the Arabs. In 826 A.D., there was no mummies found inside. There's no Egyptian hieroglyphs carved anywhere in any of the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau. There's nothing that links them whatsoever to the Egyptians. There's a lot of people that are beginning to say that the pyramids were probably built around somewhere between 10 and 12,000 B.C., and then the Egyptians came together as a cohesive social culture in the third millennium B.C., and they saw these magnificent structures, and they attempted to copy them, and they built the other pyramids that are at Memphis and Dashur and Saqqara, which are all falling apart. But the pyramids that we see on the Giza Plateau, especially the so-called Great Pyramid, the legends indicate that the structure actually, rather than being a funerary structure, was an initiation chamber, and that people would go to a certain school, an esoteric school we call the Halls of Amenti, that is evidently somewhere beneath the ground between the Sphinx and the pyramid, and they would go to school here for a long time until they were considered ready for a final initiation, and then they would be taken inside of the Great Pyramid and placed in this box that was right in the main chamber. And that the whole pyramid itself focuses energy in such a way, and if people think that's absurd that a structure could focus energy, you can get Scientific American magazine, and in the back of it you can buy these little replicas of the pyramid, and you orient them to the same astronomical and geographic orientations, and you can put a dull razor blade inside of it, and in a few days the razor blade will be sharpened. Now, they don't know how this happens, but the structure itself seems to focus energies in such a way that it does that. Well, so imagine what the enormous structure of the pyramids, the huge stone one, does to the human mind, how it focuses and sharpens the human mind. And that's what I believe the pyramid was actually used for.
Now, of course, people have said that many people going in there have come out mad, and mad meaning crazy. What is your thought about that?
Well, you find that reported a lot of sites around the world, that when people go into the sites, sometimes people actually physically disappear. There's been a whole bunch of accounts of people going into the King's Chamber and disappearing completely, or disappearing and ending up at the bottom of this long shaft kind of well at the bottom of the pyramid, and there's no explanation for this. But some people go into these sites and they have very disturbing experiences, and my explanation would be that they're not really ready to go to one of these places, that the energies affect their consciousness in such a way, perhaps it accelerates spiritual growth too much so, and it's very disturbing for people. Other people, who have practiced a lot of meditation, when they go into these sites, they feel a profound experience of peace and inner warmth.
A good example of the importance of the understanding of the summer solstice and the winter solstice and these cross quarters is, you believe, and of course you have quite a bit of evidence, that there's a very good reason why Christmas Day is December 25th. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, Christianity came into Europe between the 2nd and the 7th century, and they wanted political control of Europe. And the way to get political control of an area is to get religious control. So you take over the shrines, and you take over the sacred days at the shrines. So the Christians came in, and they tore down the stone rings, and they broke up the stones and used those stones to build churches. And then they began, the people would come, and miracles would occur. Now, we have no evidence of miracles occurring prior to the arrival of Christians at these sites because the people didn't keep written records. So we don't know, that we have no history for them. But in Christian times, at these sacred sites, in all pre-Reformation pilgrimage cathedrals in Europe are at places that were sacred to pagan people prior to the arrival of the Christians. Well, miracles were occurring when the Christians were there, and they said these miracles had to do with the churches, had to do with the relics of the saints, had to do with Christ, and the prayers that people were making. But in actuality, they have nothing to do with that. Because when Christian pilgrimages came to these sites, they went inside of the cathedral, and the cathedrals had been built in the where the stone rings were. And the relics that are in the cathedrals are stored in the middle of the cathedral, which is where the middle of the stone ring was. So people, when they're viewing the relics, they're standing basically in the middle of the stone, where the stone ring used to be. And when are they there? Well, those 8 major Christian festival dates are on those ancient earth spirit dates, the solstices, the equinoxes, and the cross quarter days. So in medieval Christianity between the 9th and the 15th century, when there was this enormous outbreak of miracles all over Europe, and they were all attributed to the relics of the saints. But again, we have to see that people were standing in the middle of the stone ring on those particular dates of the year, so it's very likely that the earth energies were affecting them just as they had affected people in past times, but ancient people had left us no record of that.
All right, now,
you find the same thing happened in all over the so-called New World when the Christians came over here. They took over, all of these sites in Yucatan and all over Mexico. You'll find loads and loads of churches there. And if you do a bit of research, you find out it was a ceremonial site of the people long before the Christians ever came.
Now, of course, historically, we know that December 25th is not even indicated as the date in the Bible. And you actually show that particular time was just a time that the Christians decided to make Christmas be. Is that correct?
Well, and also it's because, you know, there were festivals that had been happening at that time, and they wanted to continue to utilize the time. So they just took over the time. And if you think about it, in Europe, prior to the 1500s, there was very little reading and writing. You know, the printing press hadn't been invented yet. And the only people that read or wrote were some of the scribes in the monastery. There were no schools. There were no libraries. Nobody could go and check up on anything. Average life expectancy is also much shorter than it is now. So an ecclesiastical authority could come into a village, and they have the French and the Germanic kings. They have all this power, these knights and military force with them, And they tell these uneducated, illiterate peasants that they tear down, you know, a ceremonial site and they build a church and they forcibly Catholicize the people, and then they tell them that what the ancient people believed is not correct and the Christian dogma is correct. Well, if there's force behind it, you're going to accept that, and then in a matter of two or three generations, the legends change. So Christianity just took over all of the ancient myths and made them their own.
All right, let's go ahead a little bit, and matter of fact, what I'd like to do is kind of pick up something you talked about. Would it be possible for our listeners to get a gist of this technique of planetary acupuncture that you have developed?
Yeah, it's. I'm not at all hesitant to talk about it. I try to share it with as many people as possible, but it's very helpful to see some diagrams. Essentially, what I was shown was a breathing technique that, by focusing on the breath, one was able to bring energies into the body and concentrate those energies in the body and then emanate them out from the body. And on the first breath, as one is breathing, and it doesn't really have anything to do with the breath, but while you're breathing, you're just focusing your attention in a particular place. During the inhalation of the first breath, you bring energies in from the top of your head, from the stars, the celestial realms above you, in through the top of your head into your heart. And on the exhalation, you send those energies down into the earth. And it's kind of the stars in your heart are cooperating, getting together to express love to the earth. On the second breath, on the inhalation, the energies come the other direction from the earth into your heart, and on the exhalation, they're expressed to the stars. And on the third breath, the energies come together. The celestial and the terrestrial energies come together at the same time, and they meet in your heart. And on the exhalation, they're emanated out from your heart as a sort of beam or a pulse of love that goes out every direction in a spherical order and goes out and touches, according to the information I received, every living thing upon the earth. And I've been practicing this meditation technique now for 4 years, and I find it's very peaceful to do it. And it also, I feel, it's very hard to explain this or prove this, but I feel the earth is very happy with what I do. The earth is very happy when people go to these sites and they meditate and they get more in touch with these earth energies, and they come to understand that the earth is a living being, and the earth is a conscious and sentient living being, and that we can actually be in relationship with it.
How would a person find a site that was close to them?
Well, there's two ways. You can go to a library and check out a few books on the archaeology and anthropology of where you're living and find out the earliest people that lived in this area in Neolithic times and where their settlement sites were, and then go to those sites. And the earliest settlement sites are usually going to be these PowerPoints. The other thing is you can get in touch with a dowser through the American Society of Dowsers, and there's local chapters. The American Society of Dowsers is in Danville, D-A-N-V-I-L-L-E, Vermont, and you can call up just information for Danville, Vermont, and get their phone number, and they'll give you names of dowsers in your local area, and by getting in touch with these dowsers, they often have done a lot of research and know where these sites are in any particular area of the United States.
What I thought I would do is review, just for those of you who are listening, real quickly, this breath technique that he spoke about. Fortunately, I have the pictures in front of me, but just to review, it's inhaling, bringing down celestial energies through your head to your heart, and then exhaling, and of course you can correct me if I'm wrong, exhaling down into the earth. That would be the first part of the breath cycle. Then the second breath cycle, as I understand it, is to bring the energy up from the earth to your heart, and then exhale out through your head towards the stars. And then the third is to inhale both from the celestial coming down into your heart and also from the earth coming up, and then exhale out almost in a 360-degree manner. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds good. And again, it doesn't really have anything to do with the breath. In one sense, the breath is just a time for you to focus. While you're inhaling, you're focusing on these energies coming in through the top of your body. The energies are always going both ways at all the time. But by focusing our concentration upon them, we add our own psychic, our own spiritual energy to it. And so you just focus with the breath. But in Hinduism, they often talk in pranayama about you bring a certain prana or a life force in through, actually into your body through the breath, through your nose. Well, in the meditation technique that I do, the prana or this life force isn't coming in through the breath. It's passing through the chakras, through the crown chakra on the top of your head and the root chakra and your bottom. But you use the breathing just to focus your attention for that period of time while you're focusing on the energies going one way. And you had mentioned, Bruce, about that I've written this book called Planetary Acupuncture. The book has not yet been published, but manuscripts are available. It's a very detailed manuscript. It's 110 pages long with a lot of anthropology in it and a lot of the information, visionary information I received.
In Chapter 5 of your book, you talk specifically about oracle sites and visions of the future. Let's talk a little bit about the future.
Okay. Well, before I started receiving the information that I put in that book, in that chapter, as I was traveling around the world, I started doing a lot of research into ancient prophecies. You know, a lot of people have heard about Nostradamus. Well, all over the world there are accounts of people having had visionary experiences where they saw visions of the future and they reported that, they shared that with the people. I thought that was real interesting. I just studied those. Then I became in contact with a lot of current psychics, and a lot of psychics nowadays are also talking about visions of the future in a time of great crisis followed by a time of global awakening. Concurrent with my study of those two things, I began at some of these sites also receiving some visionary information that seemed to indicate the same sort of thing, that we are going to approach in the next 10 to 15 years a period of extraordinary crisis upon this planet followed by a period of global awakening. So the last chapter in my book is all about those visions and then gives certain suggestions to people about how they can deal with those two things.
Let's be specific. You talk about healing and strengthening a person. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Well, what I feel about that is that it's pretty simple stuff. People should just take care of themselves. And there's, you know, if you're living back in the 7th century, 4th century, 2nd century, you didn't know how to eat well. Nowadays, people know how to eat well, and they know that exercise is critically important, and they know they shouldn't smoke cigarettes and drink a lot of stimulants and be out in the sun too much. You know, people know what to do, so I often encourage the people that come to my slideshows are usually pretty conscious, pretty ecologically aware, pretty spiritual people, and yet sometimes they're overwhelmed by the intensity of life, and they get a little bit lazy. And I feel that a lot of the people that I'm speaking to, they really have a purpose in their life. Even if the purpose is to bring up their children well, or they're an environmental activist, or they're a teacher, but if there's something that you're here on the planet to do, you're going to be able to do that thing better if you're really healthy. And so it's very, very important to take care of ourselves so that we can, in fact, do our service. If you're sick, you can't do your service well. So I'm always talking to people about be strong, be healthy, be strong, be healthy, take care of yourself. You know, nowadays they talk about environmental pollution, transboundary air pollution. You can just be living in one place and the air can be polluted, and it's not polluted because of anything you're doing or any industries that are around your area, but it's being blown in. And there's a lot of evidence that indicates that environmental pollution is going to cause a great outbreak in cancers. You know, there's going to be a whole lot more disease in the next 10 to 15 years just because the environment is getting so sick. And so it's very important for people's immune systems to be strong. So we need to prepare ourselves for this by taking care of ourselves now.
We have just a few moments, and I wanted to tell people about something I thought was very interesting in the last chapter of your book. You say, do something of environmental or social service at least 2 full days a month. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, again, that to me, service is an expression of gratitude to the universal creative essence, that thing we might call God. We human beings are so lucky to be living, such a wonderful thing to be alive. And we're given this air to breathe, and we're given the food to eat, and we have a planet to live upon, and we have so much, and very few people ever give anything back. And I think it's very important to do something of service as a way of saying thank you to God, as a way of saying thank you to the earth for our time of being here, and not be so selfish to always just take, take, take. And the planet needs the service, and the people need the service. So I suggest to people to do something of service, and that doesn't necessarily mean your job. I mean, take some time off from what you normally do and do something of service.
All right. Well, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for being on the show, Martin Gray.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce.
And for those of you who are listening, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one. Remember, the knowledge is timeless, and you are the Voyager.